Lecture 24, Philip, Alexander, and Greece in Transition.
Welcome back to this, our last lecture in this series of lectures on ancient Greek civilization. In our last lecture, we were looking at the early part of the 4th century, the so-called Cinderella period of Greek history, and I presented the argument that while politically the period represented a dead end in the sense that the Greeks had fought themselves to a kind of standstill and seemed incapable of producing any better political form than the polis and seemed mired in this endless cycle of wars and conflict, I also argue that on the other hand, culturally, it was still an extremely active and vital period, and that we saw here signs of a transition from the classical world into what will be some of the dominant themes of the Hellenistic period, such as a much greater interest in the individual, in things like the characters of Theophrastus, or even in the artwork of some of the sculptors of the period. But if we're pulling together our survey of Greek history, we really have to finish with a consideration of the role of Philip and Alexander, because the history of the Greeks that has developed continuously from 1000 BC onwards will, of course, be fundamentally altered now. It will be with Philip that the Greeks will be defeated. As a people, they will lose their independence. And yet, at the same time, as they are being made, in a sense, politically insignificant in the ancient world, their cultural influence will be extrapolated over a vastly larger area as Hellenism, that idea of Greek identity and Greek culture, will be taken by Alexander's troops and his successors and planted as far away as the Hindu Kush. So we're dealing with dramatic events, and with events that represent something of a paradox, the diminution of Greek independence and yet the explosion of Greek culture over a much larger area. We need to talk a little first about Philip himself and about Macedon, the relationship between Macedon and Greece. Macedon is a land of inland mountains and valleys with a broad, fertile plain then extending down to the sea. And throughout the 5th and the early part of the 4th century, this was, for want of a better term, a feudal territory. In other words, it seems as if, rather than being united under one great king, though there was a Macedonian king, the various local barons who ruled in their upland areas remained relatively independent, and the strength of the king depended upon the degree of loyalty that he could get from these local barons. Philip's early reign, like that of each of the kings who came before him, as far as we can tell, going back 200 years in Macedonian history, was taken up with attempting to secure his place on the throne. He was taken up with various border wars, and during the first campaigns of his kingship, he pacified the tribes that ring the northern and western side of Macedon through a combination of military victory, marriage alliance, and outright bribery. And this combination of both military might and wily diplomacy, using any means necessary, money or marriage, this would remain the hallmark of Philip's actions throughout his career. He was, in fact, a pure opportunist. And I draw attention to that because people often speculate over the motives of Philip. What did he have in mind in relation to the Greeks and then later the Persians as well? And I think the answer to that is very simple and can be summarized in one word: more. He wanted more. And no matter what he had, he wanted more than that. There is really no theory needed to explain Philip. He simply expanded wherever there was an opening. And whenever he was blocked, he withdrew, waiting until he could expand once again. This necessarily brought him into conflict with Athens, which historically regarded the northern Aegean as an area of its influence. The Athenians had been mining at Mount Pangaeon. For years, they had a colony at Amphipolis in the 5th century up in the north. Even men like Thucydides had marriage connections and probably landholdings up in Thrace.